There is not enough uncontaminated food and water to go around. Humans fight for these resources. Only the ruthless survive. For 10,000 or 12,000 years, modern humans have depended on agriculture to survive. Agriculture is dependent on the Earth's ecosystem to produce food and supply fresh water to nourish people, animals, and plants. Months of cold and almost no sunlight after nuclear World War III triggers another series of fatal assaults on the Earth's ecosystem. Rainfall is reduced by 50%. This means the death of agriculture, the death of farming, the death of crops. After 10,000 years of planting and harvesting, humans return to a hunter-gatherer state. Before the war, meat and produce were grown on farms, shipped through the supply chain to distribution centers, supermarkets, stores, and pharmacy markets. Legumes and cereals were among the staples stored locally in cities and towns. When transportation stopped, when there was no fuel to pump, and no vehicles to drive, the distribution of food ceased. What was stored locally burned, radiated, froze, or has rotted. The people who survived the blast, wind, and fire effects of the initial nuclear war or who survived radiation poisoning and bitter cold and now begin starving to death. Across the northern hemisphere, killing frosts and sub-freezing temperatures destroy crops. Farm animals freeze to death or die of thirst or starvation. Humans are unable to start farming communities in rural areas far from ground zeros because there is very little left to grow. Months-long firestorms have heated soil to where the soil has become barren. Dormant seeds are damaged or dead. Severely malnourished survivors scavenge for roots and insects to eat, not unlike the starving citizens of North Korea before the war. The search for uncontaminated water rivals the quest for food. The radical temperature drop means that bodies of fresh water in the north temperate zone freeze over, in some places under a foot of ice. Getting surface water becomes a near impossible task for most humans. For many animals, it also means death. Lakes not frozen under deep sheets of ice have become contaminated with chemical waste products. When they finally unfreeze, they will be further poisoned by millions of thawing corpses. Water systems everywhere are in ruin. Between the nuclear explosions and the ensuing megafires, America's oil and gas storage facilities ruptured and blew apart. Hundreds of millions of gallons of toxic chemicals have spilled into rivers and streams, poisoning the water and killing aquatic life. Toxins leach into the earth and drain down into the water table. Coastal areas, saturated in extreme fallout, are littered with dead marine life. Hurricane-level storms rage along the ocean, the result of extreme temperature changes between land and maritime air masses. Survivors who make it to the water's edge in search of food have no means of getting out on the sea to fish. Filter-feeding shellfish in shallow waters are mussels, snails, and clams have mostly been killed off by radiation poisoning. Those still living are deadly to consume. In streams, lakes, rivers, and ponds, a mass extinction is underway. Reduced light devastates microscopic aquatic plant life. As phytoplankton die off, oxygen depletes, and the marine food chain disrupts, further destroying the ecosystem. After nuclear war and nuclear winter, photosynthesis can no longer keep up with plant metabolism. The plants begin to die. This happened 66 million years ago, after an asteroid struck Earth and shut out the sun. 70% of the species on the planet, that we know of, died, including all the dinosaurs, A says Toon. They either starved or froze to death. And the day a nuclear war would have many of the same phenomena that the dinosaurs experienced. A plants require sunlight for energy to grow shoots and fruits. Herbivores eat the plants. Carnivores eat the herbivores and each other. Everything on Earth lives and dies, breaks down and decomposes, all of it creating new soil in which new living things grow. This is the food chain. Not anymore. After nuclear winter, the food chain breaks down. Nothing new grows in the cold and the dark. In this scenario, in all but a small region of the Southern Hemisphere, including Australia, New Zealand, Argentina, and parts of Paraguay, widespread famine grips the earth. The conclusion drawn in 2022 by 10 scientists working on four continents, in a paper for Nature Food is succinct: more than 5 billion could die from a nuclear war between the United States and Russia. After many months, the cold and the dark become less severe. The intense effects of radioactive fog and haze diminish. The toxic smog dissipates. Light from the sun shines down on the earth once again. And with the sunlight comes yet another set of lethal consequences of nuclear war. The Tsunami-MS warming rays are now killer ultraviolet rays. For millions of years, the ozone layer protected all living things from the Tsunami-MS harmful ultraviolet rays, acting like a gentle shield. Not after nuclear war. Nuclear explosions and the ensuing firestorms inject mass amounts of nitrous oxides into the stratosphere. As a result, more than half the ozone layer is in ruin. A 2021 study on extreme ozone loss following nuclear war, conducted with computational support by the National Science Foundation, found that after a 15-year period the ozone would lose as much as 75% of its shielding power worldwide. Survivors must move underground, into the damp and the dark, into spaces infested with spiders and insects, like sucking louse. Above ground, as the sunlight dawns, things are as vile as they are below. In this new spring sun, a great thawing begins. This includes the thawing out of millions of frozen corpses now rotting in the unfiltered sun. First there was cold and famine, now there is harsh sunlight, pathogens, and plague. Insects swarm. The warm weather after nuclear winter becomes a breeding ground for disease. A study by the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation found that insects are far less sensitive to radiation than vertebrates, owing to their physiology and short life cycles. Hordes of winged and multi-legged bugs are everywhere, and are multiplying. Many of these insects are TM natural predators, like birds, have mostly been killed off by the cold and the dark. The return of the Tsunami-MS warming rays brings with it massive outbreaks and epidemics of insect-borne diseases like encephalitis, rabies, and typhus. A grand evolutionary shift is underway. Like after the dinosaurs, in this post-nuclear world, the tiny-bodied, fast-reproducing species thrive, while the large-bodied animals, so including humans, are struggle at the edge of extinction. The question remains, will nuclear weapons bring on the end of the species that made these nuclear weapons, in the first place? Only time will tell if we humans will survive. 24,000 years later. United States of America. Years pass. Hundreds of years. Thousands of years. The life-sustaining capacity of the terrestrial environment, greatly reduced at first, becomes revitalized and rejuvenated. Temperatures return to pre-war conditions. New species develop and thrive. So much has been damaged, but planet Earth has a way of always recovering and repairing herself, at least so far. The soil rebounds, as does the quality of the water supply. The ultraviolet rays that sent human survivors underground have softened and become nurturing again. If human beings do survive, how will they begin anew? And will these new humans of the future become archaeologists? Will they ever know we were all once here? 10,000, 20,000, 24,000 years pass. Roughly twice as long as the approximate amount of time it took for humans to evolve from hunter-gatherers to today. The radiation poisoning from nuclear World War III has naturally decayed. Will future humans find any traces of us? Of our societies that we once built, advanced, and made thrive? If so, perhaps that discovery will be like the discovery story of a German archaeologist named Klaus Schmidt and a young graduate student named Michael Morsch. One day in October 1994, Schmidt made a discovery in remote Turkey that rewrote civilization at TMS timeline, pushing it back thousands of years. This discovery remains shrouded in puzzles and mysteries. But the place exists as a metaphor for all of us as civilized people. For all that we know, and at the same time for all that we don't yet know, about our collective future and past. G.A. Tilda Pilcrobically Deep, a Neolithic site in Turkey, was rediscovered by archaeologists after being buried for nearly 12,000 years. Photographed by Dr. Oliver Diedrich, Klaus Schmidt was familiar with this area owing to an archaeological dig he had been working on at the time, and he was made curious by a story he had heard in the villages around the nearby city of Sanliurfa. It was said there was a hill in a valley not far away, a place where an abundance of flintstone could be found poking out of the earth. Flintstone, a sedimentary rock, was used by early humans to make stone tools and start fires back in the Stone Age. Schmidt asked around the villages to see if anyone was familiar with this place, which, decades earlier, had apparently been misidentified by an American archaeologist named Peter Benedict as being some kind of medieval cemetery. Misidentified, then forgotten about. Until, that is, an elderly man in Aaron Sikkoi, as of Akyildiz, told Schmidt, yes, he knew about this place. Locals called it G.A. Tilda Pilcrobically Teep Zirit, or the Potbellied Hill Pilgrimage Site. The way to find the site, said Yildiz, was to look for a lonely tree on top of a hill. And because this tree was the only thing growing in an otherwise vast expanse of desolate terrain, it was said to have magical powers. People called it the Wishing Tree and would journey there, Yildiz told Schmidt, a to present important desires to the branches and thus the wind. A in his book G.A. Tilda Pilcrobically Deep, a Stone Age Sanctuary in Southeastern Anatolia, Schmidt recalled how Yildiz helped arrange for a taxi driver to take him to this mysterious site, and for a local teenage boy to act as a guide. Accompanying Schmidt on the journey that day was the archaeology graduate student Michael Morsch. Morsch tells us how the area outside the bustling city of Sanliurfa was a vast and barren wasteland. Hundreds of square miles of red-brown earth littered with stones and patches of dry grass, Morsch recalls. Very little could flourish there, or so it seemed. It was as if no one had ever lived there at all. They drove for 8 miles, until the road came to an end. The group exited the taxi and began walking along a goat path toward what was rumored to maybe be the site in question. We moved through a bizarre landscape of black-gray stone blocks which again and again made little barriers, Schmidt wrote, forcing us to change our course to the left and to the right, zigzagging, as if walking through an ankle-high labyrinth of natural stone. Finally, the group reached the end of this strange terrain, which opened up to a wide expanse where one could see for miles all the way to the horizon. Looking out over the land, Schmidt felt disappointment. Nowhere was the slightest archaeological trace, only those of flocks of sheep and goats which were taken here every day to their barren meadows, he lamented. Then he saw the tree. It was almost a picture postcard image, Schmidt wrote. The wishing tree, alone, on the highest peak of the mound, obviously marking a zirit. The wishing tree at G.A. Tilda Pilcrobically Deep, in 2007. Today it is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Photograph by Dr. Oliver Diedrich, of course, thought Morsch. A pilgrimage site. We had found G.A. Tilda Pilcrobically Deep, Morsch recollects of that moment in time. But what was here? With his scientist at TMSI, Schmidt wondered. Which of Natura TMS powers could be supposed to have created this pile of earth on the highest part of this limestone ridge? In other words, what or who made this hill? A geologist might say that the hill was created by movement from the earth at TMS plates. A religious man might invoke God. Schmidt, an archaeologist, recognized right away that what he was looking at was a man-made telephone. A tell is an artificial topographical feature consisting of material left behind by generations of humans who once lived there. Excitement rose within him. As it turned out, he had discovered a lost civilization. Lost for nearly 12,000 years. But not only that, Klaus Schmidt had found something that would change modern man's very definition of civilization itself. Of how the very human concept of science and technology systems first came to be. Schmidt and a team of archaeologists began excavating the hill. They discovered potsherds and stone walls. They discovered huge pieces of quarried stone carved with wild animals like fox, vultures, and cranes. They discovered giant T-shaped pillars standing upright nearly 20 feet tall. But most important of all, they discovered a vast system of rooms, halls, and open-air auditoriums. Spaces with benches and altars carefully carved of this same stone, brought here mysteriously from a stone quarry located many miles away. Before this find, scientists at EM's general view of civilization was that science and technology had been born out of agriculture, out of farming. That only after humans had learned to domesticate plants and animals did they transition from the nomadic hunter-gatherers they once were to become civilized, to build communities and societies, to design and create complex systems of things. G. A. Tilda Pilcro Bickley-Teep disrupted this long-held, foundational idea. The site was constructed by prehistoric architects, builders, and engineers. Architects who existed before agriculture and farming came to be. Hunter-gatherer humans who dreamed up this science-based project known to us today as G. A. Tilda Pilcro Bickley-Teep. They organized work parties to carry out what they had to have carefully and systematically mapped out, or imagined, in their minds. These were hunter-gatherer humans with a complex system of systems in play, with an elegant understanding of a system's architecture, of hierarchical command and control. As of early 2024, no living quarters have yet been found at G. A. Tilda Pilcro Bickley-Teep. No cemeteries, no bones. In other words, people didn't live here, it seems, but they gathered here for centuries, perhaps even thousands of years. Why? We don't know. To do what? We don't know. And then, even more mysteriously, the archaeological record suggests that over a relatively short period of time, thousands of years ago at G. A. Tilda Pilcro Bickley-Teep, some unknown catastrophe struck. Not a natural one, like an earthquake, or a meteor strike, or a flood. Instead, rather suddenly, the entire place was over. Done. Disused. Backfilled in with earth and stone. If this was by intention, or disaster, scientists have yet to discern. Excavations continue, and the mystery remains. From that enigmatic moment forward, G. A. Tilda Pilcro Bickley-Teep became a buried time capsule. It lay hidden beneath the earth for thousands of years. What happened at G. A. Tilda Pilcro Bickley-Teep? What caused these humans to suddenly meet their end? Michael Morsch has no answer to this riddle. We can tell you what they ate, A. Morsch says, referring to modern man's astonishing ability to gather plant DNA from fireplaces and pits used 12,000 years ago. We can tell you what animals they hunted, but we can't tell you what they were thinking. Or what happens to them. A for us, millennia after a full-scale nuclear exchange, it could be the same. Humans of the future could find remnants of our present-day civilization and wonder how did it fall into disuse? What happened to them? In the dawn of the nuclear age, Albert Einstein was asked what he thought about nuclear war, to which he is said to have responded, no, not with what weapons World War III will be fought. But World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. A stones, attached to sticks, or spears, are how Stone Age people fought wars. The Stone Age era, that vast prehistoric period that lasted for several million years, during which humans used stones to make tools, so ended some 12,000 years ago, right around the time that hunter-gatherers are understood to have built G. A. Tilda Pilcro Bickley-Teep. Albert Einstein feared nuclear weapons could, and might, put an end to the advanced civilization that mankind had spent the last 12,000 years creating. Einstein feared that humans could become hunter-gatherers again, All because of a terrible weapon civilized humans had created to use in wars against their fellow so-called civilized humans. The story you have just read imagines exactly this. A story where 12,000 years of civilization in the making gets reduced to rubble in mere minutes and hours. This is the reality of nuclear war. For as long as nuclear war exists as a possibility, it threatens mankind with apocalypse. The survival of the human species hangs in the balance. In the aftermath of a full-scale nuclear exchange, survivors of nuclear war and nuclear winter would find themselves in a savage world entirely unrecognizable to anyone alive today, Carl Sagan forewarned. That, save a few tribes in the Amazon or military-trained preppers, almost no one living today has actual hunter-gatherer survival skills. That, after a nuclear war, even the hardiest of survivors would have great difficulty navigating a world poisoned by radiation, malnourished and disease-ridden, while living mostly underground, riding out the cold in the dark. The population size of Homo sapiens conceivably could be reduced to prehistoric levels or below, Sagan wrote. Small groups of people would interbreed to survive, producing offspring genetically compromised, some blind. Everything collectively learned by all of us, and all that has been passed down to us by our ancestors, would become myth. With time, after a nuclear war, all present-day knowledge will be gone. Including the knowledge that the enemy was not North Korea, Russia, America, China, Iran, or anyone else vilified as a nation or a group. It was the nuclear weapons that were the enemy of us all along. Acknowledgements. Nuclear war is insane. Every person I interviewed for this book knows this. Every person. The whole premise of using nuclear weapons is madness. It is irrational. And yet here we are. Russian President Vladimir Putin recently said that he is not bluffing about the possibility of using weapons of mass destruction. North Korea recently accused the US of having a sinister intention to provoke a nuclear war. We all sit on the razor's edge. What if deterrence fails? Humanity is just one misunderstanding, one miscalculation away from nuclear annihilation. A United Nations Secretary General Antetokounmpo warned the world in the fall of 2022. This is madness, he says. We must reverse course. How true. The fundamental idea behind this book is to demonstrate, in appalling detail, just how horrifying nuclear war would be. Fittingly, I must first thank the dead. Alfred Odendal, 1922-2015, taught me about nuclear bombs. In our interviews, over 4.5 years. He shared with me information that was not only extraordinary, but unparalleled. As a member of EGAND-GAT-EMS four-man arming party, responsible for final connection checks before all nuclear tests, Odendal wired, armed, and or fired some 186 of America-TMS atmospheric, underwater, and space-based nuclear weapons, including the ones at Operation Crossroads. Colleagues called Odendal the Triggerman. Ralph Ogema Friedman, 1927-2018, also with EGAND G, photographed thousands of these nuclear bomb tests, at the Nevada test site and in the Marshall Islands. I chronicle his eyewitness account of watching the 15-megaton Castle Bravo bomb detonate in the Pentagon at TMS Brain. Dr. Albert D. Budda Whelan, 1929-2013, shared with me tales from his legendary career of AFists. He helped develop America TMS first intercontinental ballistic missile, the Atlas. America TMS first spy satellite, codenamed Corona, and he served as the CHUA TMS first director of its Directorate of Science and Technology, DS&T. He was also the AE mayor of Area 51. His words. His life here TMS work was dedicated to preventing World War III, Whelan told me. Colonel Hervey S. Stockman, 1922-2011, lived an extraordinary life. He fought Nazis in World War II, flying 68 missions in a P-51 Mustang. He was the first man to fly over the Soviet Union in a U-2 spy plane. He flew radiation sampling runs through megaton-sized thermonuclear bomb clouds in the Marshall Islands. He flew missions in the Vietnam War until he was shot at, crashed, was captured, tortured, and made a prisoner of war for almost 6 years. After his March 1973 release, Hervey insisted on wearing his POW uniform to medals ceremonies, much to the Pentagon TMS chagrin. "AO, the invitations stopped coming," he told me. "AO, they wanted war heroes, not former prisoners." A. Charles H. Towns, 1915-2015, who won the Nobel Prize in 1964, left a profound impact on my thinking, which I write about in Phenomena. The concept of dual-use technology, a science that can be used to help or to harm, is a paradox. Town is a TMS invention. The laser has done so much to benefit mankind, from laser surgery to laser printers, but the Pentagon TMS classified laser weapons program is fostering a new kind of arms race. Dr. Walter Monk, 1917-2019, geophysicist and ocean scientist, worked on anti-submarine warfare and marine acoustics for the Navy. He generously shared with me stories of ocean science experiments he conducted during nuclear bomb tests in the Pacific. He advised presidents, held the title of Secretary of the Navy Research Chair in Oceanography, and revolutionized Marner TMS understanding of the sea. Colleagues called him the A.O. Einstein of the oceans. A. Edward Lovick Jr., 1919-2017, the grandfather of stealth technology and longtime employee of Lockheed Skunk Works, taught me many things over 10 years of interviews. His take on scientific revelation is priceless. Lovick unlocked the long-held quest for stealth technology serendipitously, he explained, ever while changing his child a TMS diaper. His AO Eureka. A moment came when he realized the secret to stealth was absorption. Paul S. Kozemchek, 1948-2017, DARPA TMS longest-serving employee, shared a shocking story with me, in a 2014 interview, that planted a seed for this book. AO, guess how many nuclear missiles were detonated during the Cuban Missile Crisis? He asked, then continued, AO can tell you that the answer is not a none.ATM, the answer is a several. ATM as in 4.82 by the US on October 20 and October 26, 1962, and 2 by the Soviet Union, on October 22 and October 28, 1962, each of which was exploded in space. Firing off nuclear weapons tests in a DEFCON 2 environment was testing fate. Marvin L. A.O. Murphy Goldberger, 1922-2014. Founder of the Jason Advisory Panel, designed many weapons systems for the Pentagon. He shared with me his vast knowledge about sensor technology and its role in command and control. He also shared a regret. Goldberger told me he wished he at TMD spent more time doing science for science at TMS sake and not doing science for war. AO, at the end of your life you think about these things, he said. Dr. J. W. Forrester, 1918-2016, a pioneer in computer engineering and the father of system dynamics, schooled me on a fundamental concept underpinning nuclear command and control. It is a system of systems. A giant machine made of many moving parts. Knowing this, and knowing all machines eventually break, is a terrifying thought. Researching, reporting, writing, and publishing a book requires an enormous amount of help, of ingenuity and generosity from lots of people, and also good old-fashioned hard work. A few individuals I would like to thank here are, John Parsley, Steve Younger, Sloan Harris, Matthew Snyder, Tiffany Ward, Alan Rotbort, Frank Morse, Jake Smith Bozanke, Sarah Thejabai, Stephanie Cooper, Nicole Jarvis, Ella Kirky, and Jason Buer. Thank you, Claire Sullivan. production editor, and Rob Sternitsky, copy editor, for staying eagle-eyed all the way to the end. Many sources assisted me on background, or on deep background, as we say in the biz, some going back 10 and 12 years. I thank you.